If I was looking for a song to prep running through a brick wall, I think it'd be the chorus of that song. Man, it is so good. Especially when we sing it out like that. We're a small church, but that sounded good. Okay, we are back in our study on political theology. No, this is part nine. Now, last week we started the doctrine of lesser magistrates. I mentioned this book that is a very simple, easy read, that we're just walking through it, taking the principles out of here that say what it is, the historical doctrine, and explain it. It's called the Doctrine of Lesser Magistrates, subtitle, A Proper Resistance to Tyranny and a Repudiation of Unlimited Obedience to Civil Government. Very interesting title, and the author is Matthew Trivella. I don't know how it's pronounced. I'm not 100% sure. Before we get into it tonight, I do want to address a couple people raised the question last week about civil disobedience, because the doctrine of lesser magistrates sounds a little bit like the concept of civil disobedience. But it is specifically about a lower civil magistrate, like the actual people in office or departments, whatever it may be, some kind of lesser magistrate that's below a higher magistrate that is refusing to enforce a dictate or opposing the actions of a higher magistrate. So that's what this is about specifically. Civil disobedience is more specifically about individuals essentially doing the same thing in a way when government attempts to require us to sin or requires us or tries to get us to violate our conscience. That is where civil disobedience kicks in. That would be us on an individual level. We civilly disobey, and that's 100% justified as well. It's just not exactly what this is, although there would, I guess, if we support a lower magistrate, there is a degree of civil disobedience that we would be engaging in on an individual level. So the difference is between the magistrate level and the individual level. A good contrast would be when you think about the Jews that were in exile in Babylon. Daniel was a lesser magistrate. He held office in Babylon. So we read in Daniel 2, then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him the ruler over the entire province of Babylon. So he's a governor of some kind and a chief prefect over the wise men of Babylon. So he's the leader of the wise men. But remember, King Darius enacted that law. He got talked into this by some counselors, enacted a law about no one being allowed to pray for 30 days, and Daniel defied him, did it openly. That would be the doctrine of lesser magistrates. He would obviously not enforce that on the other wise men below him. If he's willing to break that and do it, he's not going to enforce it. So he's standing up against, that would be a lesser magistrate standing up against a higher magistrate, the king. He's only a governor. So that's Daniel. But if you think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that was more in line with civil disobedience. They were individuals, and when they, King Darius set up that idol, and he required everybody to worship it, and they said, no, we're not going to do it on an individual level. They're not a magistrate, but on an individual level, they act out of civil disobedience. That's why they got thrown in the fiery furnace or whatever. So don't hear this teaching as if we can't oppose government overreach unless we're a magistrate ourselves or unless we find a lesser magistrate that's willing to lead this charge against the higher government. Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
With the Hebrew midwives, would any of the lesser magistrates, would they be considered as deputized by the state to do what they were supposed to do?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was thinking about that because I bring them up in here. I was thinking about that too. They're addressed as a formal group by Pharaoh. Like he knows who the Hebrew midwives are and knows how to communicate to them. So I wondered that as well. I think what the principle of what they do is applicable, regardless of if it counts as civil disobedience or doctrine of lesser magistrates, because they're doing the thing that the doctrine of lesser magistrates is based in. If that makes sense. We're going to address that in here a little bit. Who was that? Was that Anna that brought that up last week? All right, so let's look at how the doctrine of lesser magistrates is justified biblically. Because we looked at it last week, we explained what it was, but we didn't really get into how it's justified. Well, to begin with, it is rooted in the historical and the biblical doctrine of interposition. Interposition, which I realize, it's not one of those names that we're imminently familiar with. We don't talk about interposition a lot, but it is one of those doctrines where the name is what it is. It kind of tells you what it is. It says what it is. Interposition is like stepping in the gap. It's willingly placing oneself between two parties, like generally an oppressor and a victim. You interpose in between the two. You step in between. Literally a position to position oneself in between. That's our interposition. So that's what interposition is. It can be done physically, of course. You can literally stand in between, like Moses with the guy beating the slave. Moses literally stood between them and then wound up killing the slave driver or whatever. But it can be done physically. David would be a good example of that. He physically goes out and faces Goliath. He's between the army of Israel and Goliath, and he interposes himself physically. And it could be done verbally, even, such as Jesus with the woman caught in adultery by the Pharisees. He basically interposes with his argument verbally, but doesn't stand up and do anything physically. He just does it verbally. How this applies to the doctrine of lesser magistrates is that the lesser magistrate places himself between the tyrant or the bad law and the people who are going to be oppressed by that tyrant or by that bad law. Some of the men on the Signal group may have seen Michael's message a few weeks back. There, right after we went through this, there are some states that are passing some very anti-constitutional gun laws, right? And I forget which one specifically. I think there's multiple ones. I know my home state of Illinois is doing it. But there's a bunch of county sheriffs that have come out and said, no, we're not going to enforce these. And some of these go to the ATF as well. ATF is trying to do it, and the county sheriffs are like, nope, we're not doing it. I think it's happening in Oklahoma. I think I saw something from a sheriff in Oklahoma. That is the doctrine of lesser magistrates right there. If a sheriff is a magistrate refusing to submit to an anti-constitutional law at the state level or even federal level, they're stepping in, they're interposing on behalf of people. Some of my friends back home are actually impacted by this. The rules are kind of shocking. And as an act of civil disobedience myself, I'm sort of ordering some parts and tools for them because they can't do it. It's illegal for them, and I get a kick out of that. I enjoy that quite a bit. I think you can say whistleblowers, they sort of interpose a little bit. They take a position of interposition, interposition. It requires a willingness to risk personal security, or you're putting yourself at risk when you do it, because generally who you're standing between is more powerful, has greater resources. They can hurt you, or they can make you suffer consequences. So it's putting yourself in a position of vulnerability for the sake of justice. And both Scripture and history are full of interposition, actually. In the last session, the example came up with the Hebrew midwives. They were defying Pharaoh. That was interposition, regardless if it's civil disobedience or doctrine of lesser magistrates. They are interposing. They are defying Pharaoh for the sake of these babies and their moms. Pharaoh is obviously one of the most powerful people on earth, and they willingly disobeyed him. They put themselves between. It's also how Solomon figured out the true mother of the disputed baby. That story in 1 Kings 3. There's two women, both claiming to be the mother of this baby, and he falsely threatens to cut the baby in half, give each mother half of the baby. And he knew that the true mother would interpose on behalf of her child out of love. She risked herself and came out and said, let her keep the child for the sake of keeping the baby alive. So he knew that the real mother would interpose. That's interposition. Another one, 1 Samuel 14. I don't know if you'll remember this story. King Saul makes a rash vow. He called down a curse on anyone that ate food before he avenged himself on his enemies that day in some fight. And his son Jonathan didn't hear this message. He eats honey. And Saul was actually going to have Jonathan killed for this. But then the people interposed. And it tells us in verse 45 of chapter 14. It says, "But the people said to Saul, 'Must Jonathan die, who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day.' So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die." Notice that. They're not asking the king. They told him nothing's happening to Jonathan. He just did this great thing for Israel. nothing's going to happen to him. Like, they're telling the king. That's interposition. They declared, not one hair is going to fall to his head. They're standing up to the king. He's obviously a higher magistrate. There's a story in church history as well of Ambrose. He was a bishop of Milan in Italy. He's pretty well known in church history, but he stood up to Emperor Theodosius, who had apparently killed something like 7,000 people in Thessalonica because they had killed some Roman soldiers, and he retaliated against them and killed like 7,000 people. And this Emperor Theodosius came to Milan, and Ambrose physically stood between him and the doors of the church, and he would not let him in unless he publicly repented and made restitution, which the emperor did. Now, the emperor could have struck him down. Ambrose put himself in a position of vulnerability. He took a risk. It worked out. Now, it does not necessarily always work out for the interposer, though, the one that interposes. A modern example from secular history might be the famous tank man from Tiananmen Square during the Chinese protest in 1989. I don't know how many of you, I'm hoping almost everybody has seen that video. A guy literally standing in front of a tank, he's just carrying grocery bags, and these tanks are rolling in to basically disband these student protests, their pro-democracy protests in Tiananmen Square, and it had been going on, and China was like, all right, enough of this, let's go blast them out, and, you know, send them in the army. And this guy stood in front of the tanks. And, I mean, China censors this, so a lot of people in China don't even know about it, but he boldly did that, these approaching tanks, and they tried to go around him, and he kept moving. You've all seen the video, I think. He's famous for that. His interposition is famous, but he was never heard from again. Very likely killed. The army went on and killed hundreds, maybe thousands of those protesters. Their whole pro-democracy movement failed. Now, I would say he's doing the right thing. It doesn't mean he shouldn't have done it, necessarily. You have to count the cost, but it doesn't always work out. Some may remember in the late 80s and the early 90s, when pro-life demonstrators actually interposed for babies by blocking the doors of abortion clinics. That's interposition. They were arrested. And when they were questioned by the press, they actually said they were practicing the historical Christian doctrine of interposition. So interposition can be dangerous. It can be costly. This actually came up that there's a pro-life demonstrator that basically got swatted. He just got acquitted, I think, this week. But they got him because they put in these laws that you couldn't block doors and you can't, there's some buffer, not allowed to block access. And one of those Planned Parenthood escorts came and was like threatening him and his son. They pushed him away, pushed him back, and then they sent the SWAT team to arrest him in front of his kids the very early morning hours, saying he violated whatever law that was. When these people did this interposition, they put in these laws saying you can't block access. And he had said, I'll turn myself in, we'll deal with this, it's on video, it's no problem. And they're like, no, we want to send a SWAT team and like create a scene and scare pro-life protesters. So it can be costly. It can be a costly thing. It can be dangerous. This guy very easily could have paid for, I think he was facing something like 11 years for pushing a guy away from his son who was threatening his son. It's crazy. When a lesser magistrate interposes, he does so on behalf of the people in defense of justice and the rule of law. It's against a higher authority, against an unjust decree, an unjust law, something along those lines. We already mentioned Daniel, but remember, that's why he got thrown in the lion's den. He willingly defied a higher magistrate, got thrown in the lion's den. And the only reason it didn't cost him his life is because of God's miraculous intervention to shut the mouth of the lions. But that is what is needed against wicked and incompetent rulers. We need a buffer to protect the people from suffering. When the wicked rule, the innocent suffer. That's a proverb, isn't it? That sounds like a proverb. If you look at some of the oppression that was happening during COVID especially, I mean, it happened here, it happened in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, a lot of the westernized countries. So much of that they were able to get away with, so much of that came from cowardly lesser magistrates gleefully enforcing the dictates of wicked and incompetent rulers. You could see it. They enjoyed it. They enjoyed the authority they got to exercise. Justin Trudeau was not personally out there arresting pastors and fencing off their churches. He had a bunch of lackeys doing the gutless cops and petty bureaucrats doing all his dirty work for him. They were the boots on the ground, right? Nothing happens without the boots on the ground. Nothing happens without the lesser magistrates enacting what the higher magistrates say has to happen. Those elites at the top are not going to come out and do anything. Tyrants have no power further than what their lackeys are willing to enforce for them, which means lesser magistrates can take their power from them. A more historic example would be our own country, which was founded by liberty-loving men interposing against the king, breaking established laws. A king and a parliament, really. The state legislators in the U.S., they weren't the U.S. yet, in the states, the colonies, these state legislators were the lesser magistrate. And they resisted King George, they resisted the parliament when they were acting tyrannical. The parliament had no legitimate authority over the colonies because they were established by royal charters. They didn't have representatives in parliament by which they could tax them. They had no representation in parliament. They didn't desire any. They weren't seeking any. So they couldn't be taxed. That's the no taxation without representation. I don't know if a lot of people realize this. They weren't just saying that because it seemed unfair to them. They're saying it because they were citing the law. Like, no, you're not allowed to tax us unless we have representation in parliament, which we don't and we don't want. So you can't tax us without representation. That's not just like, well, this doesn't feel fair. They were literally citing law. Thus, the king and the parliament were abusing their authority and they were oppressing the American colonists. Patrick Henry actually mentioned interposition in his famous Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech. If you can, go listen to or you read the whole thing. I think Colonial Williamsburg actually has a reading of it, and you can follow the transcript and you can listen. It's only like 8 minutes. It's so good. It's really, really good. So I would recommend listening to it. But he says, he's basically speaking to these people, and the whole idea behind the speech is, you know, they keep going back and forth, and he's like, look, this war's already begun. Like, stop putting your hope in these fanciful expectations of reconciliation. This is done. We've done everything we can. Stop it. We have to fight. He's basically urging them, like, assemble a militia. We gotta get ready for war because the war has started. But he's saying to them, he's begging the legislature there. He said, sir, we have done everything that could be done to avert the storm which is now coming, meaning the war. We have petitioned. We have remonstrated. We have supplicated. We have prostrated ourselves before the throne and have implored its interposition to arrest thy tyrannical hands of the ministry and parliament. They're saying they were asking the king to step in between them and parliament who's trying to tax them and do this other unjust stuff. We've interposed. We've asked them to interpose. And they're not doing it. Our petitions have been slighted. Our remonstrances have produced additional violence and insults. Our supplications have been disregarded, and we have been spurned with contempt from the foot of the throne. In vain, after these things, may we indulge the fond hope of peace and reconciliation. So he's saying, look at all this work we've done. And it hasn't worked at all. They're not interposing. We've done everything right. This war is coming, and it's silly. It's in vain if we indulge hope for peace and reconciliation. Like, get a grip on what's really happening here, is what he's saying. Now, Patrick Henry was a lesser magistrate. He served in the House of Burgesses in the Virginia legislature. And he had duly constituted and lawful authority. He stood on the rule of law, he stood for the rule of law, and he provided a shield and a rallying point for the people. Not only that, but he considered it his duty to speak up, both as a patriot and a Christian. And he said this near the end, he said, should I keep back my opinions at such a time through fear of giving offense, I should consider myself guilty of treason towards my country and an act of disloyalty toward the majesty of heaven, which I revere above all earthly kings. It's a great speech. You got to read the speech. So, he considered acceptance of injustice as disloyalty towards God. If we let this injustice go, if we don't speak up against this injustice, we are being disloyal toward the majesty of heaven, which he regards higher than earthly kings, right? He says it's his duty to interpose. It is his duty, his Christian duty, his patriotic duty, which is less important, but meaningful still. Now, we're going to talk about the duty of lesser magistrates, unfortunately, next lesson, not this time. We'll talk about the duty when it comes to these lesser magistrates interposing, what they ought to be doing. But I want to talk about authority being delegated authority first. The idea that all authority is delegated authority, really. God, of course, is the ultimate authority. He's the ultimate lawgiver. He's the ruler. All authority comes from God. And he has delegated for us realms of authority such as self-government. We have self-government over ourselves, family government. There's family structure, fathers as heads of the house, fathers and mothers ruling over their children. There's church government. He has offices in church government, elders and deacons, and civil government. Of course, he has established civil government. And this is why Romans 13 is important. And this is why we keep going back to it. So he's delegated these realms. And each one of these realms has its own role, its own function, and its own jurisdiction. Its own jurisdiction, too. Whatever authority is possessed in those realms, from fathers to head up their homes, to pastors governing churches, to cops, to presidents, it's always delegated authority. It is derived from God. Everybody's authority in each of those realms is an authority derived from God as he established those. Thus, none of their authority is ever autonomous or unconditional. It is God-given, and therefore anyone with authority has a duty to govern in accordance with his rule. They don't get to say and do whatever they want in any realm. That's not supposed to ever happen. I'm going to read a few. Proverbs 8 is 12 through 16. This is where it's anthropomorphizing wisdom, sort of. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and I find knowledge and discretion. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogance, and the evil way and the perverted mouth I hate. Counsel is mine and sound wisdom. I am understanding. Power is mine. By me kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles who judge rightly. Which is their duty to do. And it's by godly wisdom. It's supposed to be by godly wisdom. Hosea 8 as well. Isaiah is condemning Israel. Israel has rejected the good. The enemy will pursue him. They have set up kings, but not by me. They have appointed princes, but I do not know it. So you can't just put anyone in these roles. You're supposed to be thinking about the types of rulers God would have. Rulers are judged for the manner in which they govern. All types of rulers, all types of governance, from dads to despots, everybody is going to be judged in the manner in which they rule. A father does not have authority to tell his children to steal. You know, go rob that store. I don't feel like paying for food this week. Go rob that store and help put food on the table. He doesn't have autonomous rule. He can't command. He does not have the authority. He has authority over his kids, but he doesn't have the authority to tell them to do that sort of thing because his authority is not autonomous. His authority is delegated to him from God. A child is not obligated to submit to a command to rob a bank if their father says so. If a father's thinking like, oh, well, they're not going to put a child in jail, you go in there with that gun and try and rob that bank. The child is not obligated to submit because he's under that father's authority. That's not how it works. It's not autonomous authority. Church elders are likewise restricted, right? I hope no one thinks that we are autonomous as church elders. You do not want us ruling autonomously. We will make shipwreck of this church if we rule autonomously. We will do so quickly, I'm sure. You don't want autonomous ruling elders that just make things up and like have preferences and make rules based on their preferences and whatever it may be. But also, civil magistrates are limited. They are limited. What is this? A proper resistance to tyranny and a repudiation of unlimited obedience to a government, civil government. That's because their power, their authority is limited. They can't just make up whatever they want. They cannot rule by fiat because they are not God. Their authority is delegated to them. So remember, what's Romans 13? For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. He establishes these authorities. Now, this is speaking of authority in the general sense, right? The authorities are needed because the realms in which we live need to be governed. Churches need to be governed. Civil governments need to be governed. Families need to be governed. There's not supposed to be anarchy anywhere. That does not mean that every individual is established by God, as in they're all legitimate, right? God's picking evil rulers and putting them in. Now, obviously he's sovereign. I'm not denying that, of course. He's sovereign over everything. He's decreed all things that happen. That includes wicked rulers, awful rulers. But he isn't speaking of individuals here, per se, in Romans 13. He means governing authorities in general. That are there, they are there for a reason. God has established governing authorities in these realms for a reason. That's what it's talking about. Not like Muammar Gaddafi was, you know, put there by God and is therefore legitimate and everybody must submit to him necessarily. It's not talking about individual level. It's talking in the general sense. So when it says in verse 2, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinances of God, that doesn't mean whoever resists a particular individual who is in authority. He's condemning those that resist the existence of governing authorities in general. Like, I don't want anyone in authority over me. I don't want a state authority. Like, no, God has established state authorities. That doesn't mean, like, it's wrong to oppose an evil ruler. God doesn't want anarchy. State authority is delegated by God, which means that state authority is under his authority, and they are limited. They have no right to govern in contradiction to his rule. Again, I'm going to cite from our own history again here, U.S. history. Not because I'm like, you know, so pro-American and everything America does is right, and if I can cite it from America, therefore it must be true and you need to listen to it. No, I'm just doing that because U.S. history is obviously the most pertinent to us, and we know it the best, and we want to apply this theology to our context, and American history is our context, right? But anyway, the founders recognized limited government that must rule under God's authority. They recognized this. They said our rights came from our Creator. They are not from the government, they are from the Creator. And because they're from the Creator, that's the reason they are unalienable, inalienable. That is, the state cannot violate them. The state can't take them away. They can try, not that they can't try. It's not theirs to control. They said, in fact, they exist to secure those rights. The purpose of the government is to secure and protect those rights. And that is why Paul says the state is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. That's what they're supposed to do. When there's evil practicers, the state is supposed to protect the rights of the people that are being oppressed by the evil practicers. So it's obviously not about punishing every single evil, right? It's not like the state is there to punish lust or covetousness or faithlessness or, you know, some of these internalized sins. He's saying they're there to punish those that practice evil, those that violate the rights of others. That's what the government is there for. That's why they're a minister of God, to avenge. He says they're there to punish those that practice evil, those that violate the rights of others is the idea. They bear the sword. Murderers get put to death. Thieves are forced by the point of the sword to pay restitution under threat of the violence from the state. That's why they bear the sword, to force evildoers to do right, to avenge the innocent. Thus, follow this now. When the civil government ceases to do those duties, when they're not doing what God established them to do, they are the ones resisting established authority. They are the ones violating Romans 13 because they're not doing what God established them to do. They're not doing their job. It's not the people that oppose them. It's them resisting authorities because they're not doing the authority they're supposed to do. It is not the people that want a good and fair government that legitimately protects rights. It's not them that are resisting authority. They want it. They're standing for the rule of law. They want a good authority. They're not saying get rid of all authorities and violating Romans 13. They're saying get an authority in there that practices authority as a delegated authority. Doing what they're the one upholding Romans 13. And when the state government is saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to allow these babies to be butchered. No, they're illegitimate, and they are right. They're the ones not doing Romans 13. They're disobeying it. They want the authorities. The people want good and fair government. They want authorities to govern, and they are willing to be subject to those authorities when they govern the way they're supposed to. They are not opposing the ordinance of God to have authorities in place. They are, in fact, fighting for such authority. We wouldn't accuse, think about this, we wouldn't accuse an abused child of rejecting God-ordained authority if he fled from his parents or sought protection from himself. Would we? If a kid is going to be abused and he picked up a weapon and he's like, don't you touch me again. Would we be like, hey, your parents are in designated authority from God. You have to submit to them. No. This kid wants the right authority. It's the abusive parents that are violating Romans 13. They're rejecting God-ordained authorities by not doing their job. You see what I mean? Does this make sense? It would be the parents that are rejecting God's ordained authority in such cases. When the authority gets abusive, they're rejecting Romans 13. Perverse rulers are not governing authorities to which we must be subject because they aren't governing. They're not practicing the authority God gives them. They're creating their own, which is not a real authority. It's not delegated to them. Now, don't get me wrong. The bar is high for an authority to be considered so perverse and thus rightly rejected as illegitimate. The bar is high. You know, a father commanding his son or children to sin, that type of father is rightly ignored. Darius, forbidding that prayer, commanding the worship of an idol, rightly ignored, right? It's not even a question. A legislature allowing abortion, rightly ignored. 100% justified to ignore them. They are perverse and wicked. A ruler's authority is delegated to it. It is not autonomous or unlimited. They cannot violate, oppose, or contradict God's law. And when they do, our obedience is not required. And ideally, we have a lesser magistrate there that sees that violation and takes up the cause, sees it as not only their right, but their duty to interpose against such bad governing. Calvin actually wrote of state authorities that defy or attack the law of God, and he said this: for earthly princes lay aside their power. They lay aside their power when they rise up against God, and are unworthy to be reckoned among the number of mankind. We ought rather to spit upon their heads than obey them. I was kind of surprised by that. I mean, Calvin has a much stronger view of state government and what their realm covers than we do, and even he's willing to say that. So, what we're talking about here is statism. Statism is when people believe civil government is absolute and that rights and laws originate from the state. They do not. And the doctrine of the lesser magistrate recognizes delegated authority and stands against statism because if the higher authority commands that which God forbids or forbids that which God commands, then the lesser magistrate must not obey and, if necessary, must actively resist. So, men should not give unlimited obedience to civil government. We do not give unlimited obedience to civil government. In fact, we have a duty to oppose any authority when they think they can just make up unjust or immoral laws. It is our duty to do it. And yes, we very well may suffer for it. We will become vulnerable when we do it. The lesser magistrate will become vulnerable. Our support of a lesser magistrate doing the right thing makes us vulnerable, and we might pay for it. And that's just how it is. Because Christ will rule, and he'll come back, and he'll fix these problems. And if he blesses us, if he so sees fit, then we'll have godly men in place that will make our civil governments godly, or at least just, that they rule in accordance with Romans 13. So I did want to get to that next part tonight, but we're not going to do it. I'm going to hold off on the duty of lesser magistrates so we have more time to practicing. We won't be as rushed. So any questions on that? Did I explain that well enough in Romans 13? Because it's kind of a reversal of how people think of it. I think especially during COVID, we saw so many churches just being, whatever the government says, whatever they say, you got to do. And it's just, no, that is not how it works. They don't have unlimited authority. They are denying Romans 13 when they come in here and say, you can't worship or you can't sing in your worship. I don't care what their rules or reasoning or their health require. It does not matter. They don't have the authority to do it. And we rightly resist them. We rightly ignore them. Rightly oppose them. And I think one of the reasons we're getting at this is because of how apparent this all became in the past 2 years, of how poorly the American church, at least, has, I think, just handed over obedience to civil governments when they're not seeing the realms in which they have the right to rule. I don't know. Maybe I'm not explaining that well. Any questions before? Yeah.
So does the book or whatever you've read on this, is it getting into how like the Hebrew midwives handled that situation, Ruth handled her situation? They undermine those governing authorities, basically by lying.
Yeah.
And really, the scripture doesn't really give much commentary on that.
Right.
It's meant for faith in Hebrews. But there's a. They handle that, of course, in that way, lying and reminding the authorities that be, and you can cheer them on. But on the other side of that, what would have happened had they not, and would they fall into the category that Hebrews mentioned about joyfully accepting Caesar's property for those who did not accept their redemption or their release from prisons?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a hard thing. I think there's a question of a little bit of conscience question. Which side is the weak conscience and which isn't? There's somebody. I mean, if you think about it, all of spying and espionage would be invalid as a statecraft type thing if you can't deceive in order to protect the innocent to some degree. There's a really good Thinking in Public. Al Mohler does these Thinking in Publics, and he does an interview. Oh, I think it might have been last summer or last spring. It might have been about a year now. He does an interview with a former like CIA guy, and they talk about this concept of legitimate deceit almost. Well, you said Ruth. Are you talking about Rahab?
Yeah, Rahab.
Rahab, yeah. I was questioning. I was like, what story in Ruth am I racking my brain. Yeah, Rahab deceives the city of Jericho, the authorities there. The Hebrew midwives basically lie. And I think there's a level of tactics, a question of tactics that are allowed in protection of the innocent to oppose these. You know, in the same way that you're not allowed to kill, except in just war, God commands killing. It's not murder, though. And I think lying might fall in that same realm of it's a tactic to oppose evil and protect life. I don't have it 100% worked out. He hasn't gotten into it at all yet. I don't know if he will. I haven't seen him talk about that yet. I extrapolated a good bit from here, especially on Romans 13. He didn't walk through that argument as much as I did. So I am curious, though.
Yeah, that seems tough because the pastors will belong on to the joyfully accepted property and didn't accept their release.
Yeah.
And the overly aggressive might belong on to
Rahab. Yeah. And the whole turn the other cheek argument. So I think there's a level of personal persecution that we do accept where I don't feel like we're necessarily obligated in every instance. I think that there's a question of wisdom of when to use certain tactics and when to fight. And when to, because there is a degree where you can just throw yourself at the meat grinder of the state. And it's like, I don't know if that's always the best idea. You're not going to protect your neighbor just by sacrificing yourself as a being ground up in the meat grinder of the state. So sometimes it's like you pick your battles, you suffer persecution joyfully. And then other times where it's like, all right, we have an opportunity here to protect the good, the innocent, love our neighbor by opposing this evil authority. So I don't know if there's going to be black and white answers to those.
Citizen,
they're like, oh.
Oh, yeah. They backpedal very quickly.
Yeah. So he, like, invokes his rights as a Roman citizen, which is interesting, where he's not just, like, laying it over and, like, I've got to be beaten and I have to accept this. And,
yeah. Right. And there's also instances where they know they're going to be arrested and they sneak out.
Yeah.
Like, should they submit to the governing authorities and be like, well, they've got the warrant out, it's too late now, we have to accept this and wait? Or no, they sneak away, they get away. I mean, if they can escape it, they do. So, yeah, it's a question of tactics. And then, but if they're kicking down the doors and pointing guns at your head, like, what do you do? Maybe it's the time to fight, maybe it's not. It just depends on, I guess, the particulars. I don't have it all worked out. I know that.
I mean, you could visit Washington, but I feel like Nazi Germany, when people
get yep.
in their house, that's people.
Right.
I mean, you could have straight lines to leave and take your house, but you're
all going to be hiding in their house. Yeah. Yeah, and there are actually evangelicals that say, if the Nazis came and kicked down your door and they said, are there Jews in your basement, you would have to say yes. And it's, no, I don't agree with that at all. They get weeded out quickly, yes. Yeah.
I'm just thinking of a more modern day example of kind of like the midwife. When we were in seminary in California, there was a law that was passed. Actually, one of our friends volunteered in the pregnancy center. But they required, the law required.
Oh, that's right.
All the abortion clinics.
They had to be able to refer them to abortion clinics. Yeah. Yeah. I think I'd quote Calvin there, it's better to spit on their heads than to obey them.
I just remember, yeah. What are we gonna do?
Yeah, you don't listen. Yeah, no. Yeah. See, and it's
yeah.
Yeah. I think she was. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great example of like, yeah, absolutely 100% ignore them. Not even a question.
So related to this, as far as lesser magistrate versus personal civil disobedience, to me, that business is lord over that business. They are the governing authority over that business and act as a lesser magistrate in saying no to
it. Yeah. Yeah. The government can claim authority over all these individual things and say, like, no, you don't. You don't have that authority. You can say you do, but you don't. Just, and I've used this example before, like if the state of Illinois kept sending me taxes to pay, I'm like, no, you have no authority over this household. None. And I would ignore it. And hopefully the lesser magistrate of Alabama, I guess, would stand in the gap for me. I don't know. Interpose for me.
I think, too, Kurt, it's probably a good contrast to this view of interposition versus Christ, because if you think of Christ,
yeah.
Like, we might be justified against rulers.
Yeah.
Christ interposed in the exact opposite.
100%. Yeah, that's why I said it's between two parties. Yep.
Christ is the one interposing for us that just punishment.
Yeah. Yeah. God is a just tyrant or despot, right? He's not doing anything wrong, but God, Jesus interposes himself and makes himself vulnerable and pays the consequences for it. Yeah, it's 100% gospel right there. And each I think interposition can be rightly seen as a mimicking of Christ's sacrifice. I mean, what's he say? There is no greater love than this, and the man lay down his life for his friends. If somebody interposes trying to save their friend's life and dies for it, that's Christ-likeness right there. 100%. I meant to actually get to that. Sorry, I forgot to get the gospel more focused in on that one, on this lesson, but... Yeah, Christ-likeness right there in interposition. I mean, we're talking in the context here of like oppressor versus victim, and God versus us is not oppressor-victim, but it is like authority to someone that is going to pay the price of justice. So it's still a type of interposition, though. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Okay, anything else? Are we ready to... Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's Psalm 82. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and fatherless. Maintain the rights of the afflicted and destitute. rescue the weak and the needy, and deliver them from the hands of the wicked. And I believe that's our responsibility as believers, and sometimes it does push us to deceive the devil to save the lives of the righteous.
Yeah. 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 Because how does he do it? He uses his people to do it. His hands and feet. Are, it's not every. Not every single thing is divine intervention with an angel with a flaming sword. It's. Yes, we are the divine intervention. That's exactly right. 100% agree. Yeah. Okay. That's pretty quick. And then clean up, and then we'll 10 minutes. 10 minutes, and then we'll meet back here to sing. Heavenly Father, we give you great thanks and praise for the clarity of your word, the example of Christ interposing for us, and the pattern that we see to stand up for the weak and the innocent. We do pray for bravery and boldness and discernment on how to do this rightly, when to do it, how to do it in a way that is glorifying to you and genuinely is successful at protecting the innocent. And doing the right thing, Lord. I pray that each of us would be willing to pay the cost and make ourselves vulnerable and pay the consequences of what might come from interposition if we do have the opportunity to do so. Help us to see those opportunities, to take advantage of them, and to point to Jesus Christ and his ultimate interposition if and when we have to do so. Thank you for the salvation that is found by Jesus putting himself in the gap between us and your justice. Thank you for salvation through Christ. We pray it in his name. Amen.